I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start today in Afghanistan, where insurgents launched a brazen pre-dawn assault on the huge U.S.-run Bagram airfield, killing an American contractor and wounding at least a dozen U.S. service members. It's the second Taliban strike on NATO forces in the Kabul area in as many days, and the first, yesterday, brought with it a grim milestone. 5 American troops were killed, making the toll of American dead in Afghanistan more than 1,000, the first 500 deaths in the first 7 years, the second 500 in less than 2. Dexter Filkins of the New York Times is in Kabul. Dexter, what do we know about today's attack? What did it look like?
It's interesting. There was an attack between 20 and 30 Taliban guys, 4 of whom were wearing suicide belts. Pretty clearly the plan was to bomb the gates, open the gates, and get the other guys inside. 4 of those suicide bombers were killed before they could get into position and blow themselves up. They didn't get inside. You know, they failed, ultimately. What you have to stand back and think about is between 20 and 30 Taliban fighters managed to infiltrate the town in an area that's supposed to be pretty friendly to the Americans. They were able to get in there, and they were able to get the jump on at least some Americans at the base, get the jump enough that they could kill one and wound a dozen. That's not a small number.
And what does that say to you? Because this is sort of in the north of Afghanistan. The next big offensive against the Taliban is scheduled to be in Kandahar in the south in this summer. So is this sort of a message from the Taliban? We're up here, too?
It's not the same. I mean, Kandahar is a very different place than Kabul. And Kabul, on most days, is very quiet. Kandahar, on the other hand, is, you know, that's the stronghold. But, I mean, all these things always, when you're fighting this kind of war, these things are about symbols and about sending messages. And that's what this was. That's what the suicide bombing was yesterday. We can get into Kabul. We can hit you at the base. And frankly, it's for the publicity. You know, it's psychological, but war is psychological. So that's what this stuff is about.
Well, Dexter, there's a 2-page photo spread in the Times today, and we've seen these horrible collages in the past at terrible milestones, such as the one that's just been reached. You've been embedded with troops. What are your thoughts about this number, 1,000 Americans now dead in Afghanistan? And what are their thoughts, if any? Are they aware of it?
What grabs your attention here is that the curve of American fatalities and violence is ascending. The curve is going up. Last year, 2009, was the single deadliest year for American soldiers here. And this is, you know, we're in the 9th year of the war here. So you would think 8 years into the war, things would be getting better, where they weren't. Right now, I think we're in a kind of the paradigm is shifting here, and I think the Americans and the Afghan government are trying to take the initiative away from the Taliban. It's kind of debatable whether they've done that. I mean, there's so many problems here and so many things that have to be solved. But again, as to answer your question, I think the most notable thing about the 1,000 dead is that things have gotten so much bloodier here in the last couple of years.
Well, Dexter, after the attack, again, the brazen attack on the Bagram base, which, as you said, was more symbolic than anything, what do forces there do? Is there a sense of we have to defend more against these symbolic attacks? I mean, is there any way to up anything to meet them?
Look, this all comes down to political questions and to psychological questions as much as military ones, and that is, the Taliban are trying to wear down the Americans. They're trying to wear down the American public. They're trying to wear down the Afghan government. They're trying to demoralize people. That's how you win wars in an insurgency. And I think at the same time, that's what the Americans and NATO and the Afghan government are trying to do to the Taliban. Everybody is trying to break the will of their opponents. They're trying to do it by trying to, convince Americans back home that, gee, the Americans don't even control their own bases or they don't secure Kabul. And that's what these attacks are about. So when I say they're symbolic, that's what I mean by that.
And I guess just to really underscore, you say they failed. So you're saying the Americans do control the base.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, it was 20 or 30 Taliban guys that tried to get into the Bagram air base, which is enormous. It's like the size of Cambridge, Massachusetts. They didn't get in. A lot of guys died trying. So in that sense, of course, they protect their bases. That's not what this war is about. You know, the war is not about Americans sitting on their bases and protecting themselves.
Yeah.
It's about building a state here, an Afghan state, that can stand on its own so that the United States and the rest of NATO can go home. And at this point, I think it's safe to say everybody would agree that we're a long way from that.
Dexter Filkins of the New York Times in Kabul. Dexter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a look today at the impact of Arizona's new immigration law. At least 9 states have plans to introduce legislation similar to Arizona's, which requires police, not just federal immigration officers, to question people about their status in the U.S., albeit after a lawful stop, detention, or arrest. In a moment, we'll go to Utah, but first to Pennsylvania, where State Representative Daryl Metcalf has introduced his version of Arizona's law. The Western Pennsylvania Republican says he wants to give local and state law enforcement the power to apprehend the 140,000 immigrants he says are in his state illegally. Some police officers are against these measures. They say it will strain their budgets and make them the target of lawsuits if people feel they don't properly investigate illegal immigrants as required. Reagan Cooper is executive director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition, and she has other concerns. She joins us. And Reagan, what are your concerns with the proposed bill?
We're very concerned that the trust that many members of law enforcement have worked so hard to establish will be eroded as victims of crime and witnesses of crime feel too afraid to come forward and interact with the police. That's not to mention the large costs that such a bill would impose, as we would need many more individuals added to the staff of law enforcement entities.
Well, let's take those concerns one at a time. Concerns that have been spoken on the part of police, feeling that if they're obligated to ask people to prove their citizenship, then they can conversely be sued if they don't do this. So there have been those concerns. But the Pennsylvania proposal follows Arizona's lead in that Arizona changed the law somewhat to say that local and state law enforcement could only ask people questions about their immigration status if they had a reason to stop them. In other words, if they were speeding or if they'd run a red light. So that eliminates some of the questions about racial profiling. Doesn't that give you some satisfaction?
Many folks have raised the claim that that is simply window dressing on the underlying racial profiling that the Arizona bill encourages. It's possible to engage in selective enforcement or to find a very minor issue such as a broken taillight as a pretext to pull someone over.
Well, what about Mr. Metcalf's concerns of the cost of illegal immigrants? He says they cost state taxpayers at least $700 million a year in educating the children of illegal immigrants, then the added cost of welfare benefits, jail cells, health care, daycare, food stamps.
And he proposes to fix that by spending millions and millions more on enforcement tactics that have been proven not to work.
Well, what about a counter bill from the Democratic State Senator Daylon Leach? He proposes that no state or local police be obligated to enforce immigration laws. However, they can share information they come across in the course of doing their law enforcement with federal immigration officials.
Well, the way our system is set up is that if someone has an existing warrant in the system, that will come up when police encounter them and run them. And that's a proper use of their authority. But to have law enforcement officers waste precious time determining someone's immigration status in order to pass them on to immigration authorities is a waste of their scarce resource.
Well, this is more about a police officer, say, stopping someone for speeding and having a feeling that they may be illegal immigrants and just passing on that information to the feds. That sort of takes the onus off the police, you know, the fear, as you said, that the police would feel that they'd then be liable.
Right, but what it doesn't do is address the fear of the community that any interaction with law enforcement is extremely dangerous for them. We don't want entire communities feeling that they need to avoid law enforcement. We want communities to be able to seek out law enforcement to say, hey, I saw somebody get robbed, or I'm a victim of domestic violence, I need help.
So Reagan Cooper, again with the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition, 140,000 illegal immigrants, according to State Rep. Daryl Metcalf, in Pennsylvania. What would you propose be done?
Well, immigration laws are determined at the federal level, and until we enact workable solutions there, local communities are going to continue to struggle with the impact of this broken system. What we need is for Congress and the President to live up to their promise to pass comprehensive immigration reform so that we can all move forward together to rebuild our economy and secure our future.
Now, that usually means a path to citizenship. And as you well know, Republicans like George Bush and John McCain, at least John McCain at one time, and then also Democrats like Barack Obama, you know, just run into that wall of public mood. They are not in the mood for a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants.
Well, I think the American public is also not in the mood to keep spending millions of dollars on enforcement strategies that we know aren't working, money that could instead be spent on schools and hospitals and roads. So there really has to be a balance point here. What is an appropriate punishment for having been in the country illegally, and how do we fix the system so that we won't have that issue of so many folks here illegally? And the most practical, realistic way to do that is to create a pathway to legal status and eventual citizenship. Have people pay fines. Failure to be in status is a civil offense, and for most civil offenses, we charge people fines.
Well, and some people believe those fines should be against businesses that hire illegal immigrants. But Utah just passed a law that would forbid businesses from hiring employees unless they run the employees' information through the government's E-Verify system to check to see if they're legal. But no fines are attached if they don't. Your thoughts?
The E-Verify system is something that's under hot debate here in Pennsylvania. The problem with that system is that it's rife with errors. So you get work-authorized people, including American-born U.S. citizens, who come up as not authorized to work. You get people that are unauthorized coming up as authorized. And so there's a huge problem with the accuracy of the data and also the expense of complying and setting up that whole system for small businesses, which are already struggling in this economy.
How is this debate reverberating in the community, in the immigrant community? What are you hearing from people?
People are very afraid. The message is out there that police could start doing this. In many areas of the state, a number of officers already do sometimes engage in this sort of behavior voluntarily. We've seen many local anti-immigrant laws. We've seen an increase in hate crimes, such as the murder of Luis Ramirez in Shenandoah. Members of the high school football team and former members of the high school football team obtained alcohol and encountered this young man, and his white girlfriend was with him, and they beat him, and he died. So the fear is very real.
Reagan Cooper, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition. Reagan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, today in Arizona, the Peace Officers Standards and Training Board begins work to set up a training program to help officers there avoid racial profiling. And our next guest says he's tweaking his copycat bill in Utah to prevent racial profiling by creating a higher standard for questioning people about their immigration status. We're talking about how Arizona's new law is rippling out across the country. Arizona has had impact before. In 2004, voters there approved a law denying public benefits to people in the country illegally. At least 10 other states took up at that law. We'll see how the current law is rippling out in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're taking a look today at how states are looking to copy Arizona's recently passed immigration bill that requires police, not just federal officials, to apprehend illegal immigrants. In Utah, Republican State Representative Steven Sandstrom is drafting a bill somewhat mirroring the Arizona law. He joins us. And Representative Sandstrom, let's talk about police. Many police chiefs are against this bill. They say they don't have the capability to do what the feds have always done, but also that it makes them liable and vulnerable if someone feels they haven't taken appropriate action. So would you please address that first?
The number one answer I have to that is you're sworn to uphold the law. You cannot pick and choose what law you want to uphold. And so it really kind of irritates me when I hear law enforcement say that they won't enforce the law or do not want to enforce it.
Well, but to be fair, that's not what they're saying. Critics are saying that the bill specifically obligates them to ask somebody about their immigration status, and they feel that that's something that the feds have always done, but also that it puts them in the position of being sued if, for instance, someone doesn't think that they did a reasonable questioning of someone?
Yes. Well, you know, I don't think there's a worry about being sued, but what I'm trying to change right now, the Utah law that I think will help alleviate some of those problems, I'm going to change the criteria for requiring the asking of the question of immigration status. Under the current Arizona law that was passed, it's reasonable suspicion. And I think that that could put police in a little bit of a predicament, wondering what is reasonable suspicion. And so the change that I'm going to make in the Utah law is raise the criteria to probable cause. For instance, somebody gets pulled over because they have expired license plates. They cannot give any form of identification. I mean, you are required to have identification if you're driving an automobile.
We just talked about this with Reagan Cooper, an immigration advocate in Pennsylvania, and her concern was that, yes, you have to have a reason to be pulled over, and so let's say it's the license plates, but you're saying you would take it one step further and you can't ask for immigration status unless there's some sort of secondary offense like not having your license?
Yeah, it had to be probable cause for them to feel that they have to question you. So, yeah, let's say you do not have a driver's license or you don't have any form of government-issued ID, which you are required to have. And then, let's say, with further questioning by the police, you ask, well, what's your name? And let's say that they run a name and an address that is given to them, and it comes up as a bogus name or a bogus address. At that point, then the officer could establish probable cause to at that point question the immigration status. Even though it's not a huge difference, it does give an added level of protection that would really make it nearly impossible to say that this is racial profiling if you raise it up to the standard of probable cause. Because, you know, what is reasonable suspicion? The way you look? Is it because you have an accent? So it's a little bit different that, you know, you specifically, you know, have to have another threshold that would require you to ask for immigration status.
But what about other concerns? Again, we just spoke to an immigrant advocate who said that she's very concerned that the sort of trust that exists between people and the police will evaporate. And that would undermine, first of all, the police ability to do work in immigrant communities, whether people are legal or illegal. Perhaps you might have a woman who's being beaten by her husband, but she's afraid to call police because she's now afraid of the police.
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't think that having a relationship with people, especially people that are engaged in criminal activity, is necessary or prudent. I understand where they're coming from, and that is another change.
Wait a second.
Wait a second.
Most law enforcement people would say it's absolutely prudent, especially in times of, you know, post 9/11 concerns. It's absolutely prudent that the police have relationships with communities.
Well, okay, with a community, yes, but with a criminal element within community, I would say no. You know, I don't connect the dots on this one, because if you are legal in the United States as a legal immigrant or you are a U.S. citizen, you would have nothing to fear.
I just want to be sure what you're saying. So are you saying that if there's a woman who is an illegal immigrant in the U.S., which, you know, is a crime,
yes,
and is being beaten by her husband, you don't think she should have recourse with the police?
Oh, no, she should. And this is another change that I am working into the Utah law, is to specifically state that if somebody is a witness to a crime or a victim of a crime and they're making contact with the police because of a crime that's been committed, it would forbid law enforcement from asking questions as to their immigration status. You know, when people talk generally about maybe being victims of crime and they're illegal and they're afraid to talk to authorities because of that, I mean, that could happen right now, then I do say, you know, that is one of the consequences of being in the country illegally, is that you have to be worried about coming forward and being caught.
Well, I want to broaden out and talk about some of the other plans in Utah. Utah has already passed a bill requiring companies run the names of employees through the E-Verify database. Now, right now there are no penalties for not running their names. And there's been a push to add penalties, but that has to wait till the new session. Are you worried, though, about penalizing small businesses? Are you worried about pushing business out of Utah?
No, I'm not worried about that at all. I actually use E-Verify in my business. It's very simple. It's not onerous in any way. and it's extremely effective for finding problems that people have.
Well, boycotts, they have been passed in Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Oakland. Are you worried about that? Bans on other cities on doing business with Utah?
Well, I think more of it is political posturing by some of these bodies. And overall, I think the American people support this, and they support the rule of law. You know, what Arizona's done is nothing new. It's just mirroring federal law. And so I think the more people understand it and realize that it's not this onerous law, the boycotts will be completely ineffective.
That's Utah Republican State Rep. Steven Sandstrom. Representative Sandstrom, thanks so much.
Well, you're welcome.
And this note, President Obama, speaking today at a press conference with Mexico's President Felipe Calderon, said that illegal immigration is down, not up, under his administration, and he reaffirmed his commitment to fix a broken immigration system. We'll continue to follow this story. But taking another look ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, when you listen to audiobooks, you probably don't pay attention to the narrator. One of them says that's a good thing. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, where is John Hinckley Jr.? The latest news is next, Here and Now. The scandal involving anti-gay crusader Dr. George Reekers may affect more than his personal life. Reekers is a Baptist minister and clinical psychologist who co-founded with James Dobson the Conservative Family Research Council, a Christian lobbying organization. Reekers also served on the board of the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality. And late last month, Reekers was caught by the Miami New Times returning from a 10-day trip to Europe with a 20-year-old male prostitute that Reekers reportedly met through the website rentboy.com. John Stewart weighed in, labeling the trip a European gaycation.
Reekers claimed he was merely trying to convince the rent boy to leave the homosexual lifestyle and, quote, "I shared the gospel of Jesus Christ with him in great detail." Yes, I believe they read extensively from the book of...
Well, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow took the story further and recently found Reekers' name on a letter sent to 14,000 school superintendents.
The letter advises school districts, quote, "In dealing with adolescents experiencing same-sex attraction, it's essential to understand there is no scientific evidence that an individual is born gay or transgender. It is also critical to understand that these conditions can respond well to therapy."
But as left-leaning show hosts and late-night comedians salivate, legal experts say the scandal may affect the outcome of at least one court case in which Reekers has served as an anti-gay expert witness. John Schwartz is national legal correspondent for The New York Times. John, welcome.
Thanks.
Well, let's get to the heart of this. George Reekers, 61, married. He told the Miami New Times he needed this escort to carry his luggage, but photos show Reekers was carrying the luggage. He's now not talking, but the escort told CNN he did give Reekers sexual massages. So can you tell us more about what Reekers has made into this legal career? And then we'll talk about what the conflicts are. But what has Reekers been known for?
Well, for many years, he has set himself up as an expert on homosexuality, homosexual marriage, homosexual adoption, and some of the issues of whether sexual orientation is mutable or immutable. In other words, can you be counseled out of being gay? And he has appeared in several cases, whether through declarations or testimony. For instance, in Florida, which was considering a lawsuit over a case involving gay adoption, he was an expert for the state, and he was an expert who stated that homosexuals have difficult lives and their children tend to be troubled, and so gay adoption should not be allowed and the law should be allowed to stand on the books. He got $120,000 from the state of Florida for preparing this expert testimony.
Well, let's stay in Florida because this may affect the November gubernatorial elections. Republican Attorney General Bill McCollum is running for governor. Now, as you said, there had been a lawsuit against Florida's ban on gay adoption. The court declared the ban unconstitutional, but McCollum, who's against gay adoption, is appealing the court's ruling. What are people saying that he has an obligation to do now because his legal evidence is based on Reekers' testimony?
Well, it's based largely on he's one of the two main experts the state put forward, and that testimony has come under question as Dr. Reekers' qualifications have come into question with the scandal. And McCollum himself has distanced himself from Dr. Rieger's and has said that, you know, he's certainly not going to be using him again in this lawsuit. The question is he going to go to the court now, the court in which the appeal is being considered, and say, and by the way, we're not relying on him anymore. You should know a few things about this expert.
And by the way, the court seemed to have had that feeling anyway. The judge who declared the Florida gay adoption law unconstitutional wrote that George Rieger's was motivated by his strong ideological and theological convictions that are not consistent with science. Does this mean, though, John Schwartz, that cases that have already been settled will now be appealed?
Well, it's an interesting question. It could be part of any new case brought against some of these laws, but I really don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, we'll see. John Schwartz, national legal correspondent for The New York Times. John, thanks so much.
You bet.
And quick note, another case in which Rieger gave expert testimony, a 2004 Arkansas case about an Arkansas law that restricted gay foster care. The judge deemed his testimony suspect. And George Rieger's teachings were also used in California's banning of same-sex marriage. Your thoughts? Go to hereandnow.org. Click on Contact Us to send an email or leave a comment right there. Here and Now. The afternoon of March 30th, 1981, a gunman fired 6 shots into President Reagan's entourage outside the Washington Hilton Hotel. At first, news anchors like the late Frank Reynolds of ABC reported Reagan hadn't been hit. Then, seconds later,
he was wounded. My God, the president was hit. He is in stable condition. All this information. My God, the president was hit. All this that we've been telling you is incorrect. We now must redraw this entire tragedy in different terms. The president was hit today.
4 people, including Ronald Reagan and his press secretary James Brady, were wounded that day. Brady, devastatingly so. By 25-year-old John Hinckley Jr., who was driven by his obsession with actress Jodie Foster. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity and in 1982 confined to St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington. But some 30 years later, might the man who tried to kill a president be set free? He's already spending some days sipping coffee and reading newspapers in his mother's upscale community in Virginia. Anis Shin of the Washington Post recently spent some time at St. Elizabeth's. And Anis, is it fair to say you were observing Hinckley? What was that like?
Yes, I would go there. It's a very ramshackle place, and you can sort of walk on there pretty easily and sort of sit and observe him, which other people have done before me. And he is a man of routine. He has done the same thing for years. He comes out with a bag of newspapers and magazines, and he sits and reads, or he feeds feral cats that live on the grounds, or he goes on supervised outings with other patients.
I just have to ask, is this authorized observing? I mean, could anybody have access to him? Did you get an okay?
Well, it's a hospital. I wouldn't say that it was against the rules necessarily. It's a hospital, and so people are allowed to go visit. And, you know, if you're on the grounds, you're on the grounds. You do have to show ID at the gate. But then once you're on, you know, you're like any other person visiting the hospital.
Well, that just raises so many questions, you know, about, well, maybe his safety, given people still angry at him. But you and others have observed him. It's kind of how you tell this. Does he seem insane?
Well, I mean, it's not the kind of thing you can tell by looking at him. I mean, according to the court documents, he goes to these hearings every few years where there's lengthy discussion about his condition. And essentially, the doctors, as well as the government's doctors, agree that the depression that led him to the assassination attempt has been in remission for many years. And he's on medication, and he is very compliant with all the hospital's restrictions and rules, a model patient in many ways. He has a volunteer job at the hospital library 5 days a week. He's so good at it that the librarian there has actually requested to make him a paid employee. So he seems to have adjusted very well to institutional life.
Well, and so over the years, a judge has been granting him some freedoms. And again, this is a judge, not a parole board. Last summer, the judge expanded his freedoms, granted him ability to apply for a driver's license. He's been allowed to go to Williamsburg, Virginia, where his mom and dad lived. His dad recently died. So there have been these baby steps?
There have. But in the early years, he made a lot of missteps. He wrote a lot of letters to the press saying that he was a political prisoner, and he was caught with some Jodie Foster material at one point. So when things like that happened, the judges have been reluctant to give him privileges. But then basically around, I'd say, like 2000, he kind of settled down. And so gradually his privileges have been expanded. Last year, he got 10 days a month to go see his mother in Williamsburg. It's largely supervised, but he has some unsupervised time during those visits, mostly in his mother's subdivision. And he was allowed to get a driver's license. His mother's neighbors have seen him driving, so he seems to have gotten it. And the expectation is that these privileges will just keep expanding over time.
Well, and Williamsburg, Virginia, is where Hinckley says he wants to go if, in fact, he's released. Now, when he's gone for these visits, there's a lot of restrictions. He has to give the court the names and addresses of places he plans to go. He has to take his mother or a sibling when he leaves the subdivision. His family has to fill out a report on how he was. He can only be on the internet with family supervision. You write all of this.
Yes, he faces a lot of restrictions, and part of that is to address, you know, concerns by the community, but also some of them have to do with his own treatment. For example, he's not allowed to speak to the media, neither is his family when they're with him. Part of that has to do with he has a diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, and I guess there is a sense from his treatment team that if he is given access to the press somehow, that it will fuel that.
But still, you know, on these trips, which seem to have gone well, he has to carry a GPS cell phone so Secret Service can, mm-hmm. you know, verify where he is. There's a lot of restrictions. What is the feeling on the part of the community that he might be there permanently?
It's funny. What I found was that people who saw him more regularly when he came to visit seemed to be more comfortable with him. Being able to see him somehow and, I don't know, assess his state themselves made them more comfortable in a strange way. The people who seemed less comfortable were actually the people who lived a little further away and may not even be aware of his presence when he's there. They don't see the Secret Service car parked at the end of the street, for instance.
Well, and we read that it seems impossible to others that a person who tried to assassinate the president and was also known to have stalked President Carter just a few months prior might someday be free. And there's a question of what will he do? Because you write that his social worker has been trying to find him work in Williamsburg in the event that he's released, and he didn't have any luck.
Well, what happened is the judge, it was part of the request, and the order that came down was that he had to find volunteer work in Williamsburg for a certain number of hours a week. And they found a social worker down there willing to help. And he had an incredibly difficult time finding organizations that would take him, even organizations that work with, you know, the homeless or ex-convicts or what have you. Just felt that being associated with Hinckley might be damaging to their funding, perhaps. He did end up getting a volunteer job at the state hospital there, which is basically their version of St. Elizabeth's. But I think the social worker testified that he was surprised, I guess, at the response that he got, the negative response that he got. I would say that in talking to some defense attorneys who handle cases of people who've been found innocent by reason of insanity, a lot of times, after this amount of time, those folks are free. The fact that he obviously tried to assassinate a president is what has gotten him all this sort of extra attention. But in many cases like his, he probably would actually be out on his own already at this point.
That's Washington Post reporter Annis Shin speaking to us from D.C. Annis, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Do you, or maybe someone you know, have trouble falling asleep? Try this. But only a little of this, because Brown University neuroscientist Seth Horowitz and his friend, composer Lance Massey, say it will put you to sleep. They describe their work as weapons-grade sound design. It hasn't been peer-reviewed, but they claim they've used the math behind the workings of the mind to create sounds that either make people sleep or be more focused or fall off chairs with vertigo. They're marketing these sounds through Neuropop, a company they call their hobby, because in their day jobs, Seth studies bats in order to improve designs for unmanned aerial vehicles, and Lance is a sonic branding expert who created the T-Mobile ringtone. So we have Lance to blame for that.
I'm so sorry.
Lance Massey joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hello.
And Seth Horowitz joins us from WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Seth, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Robin.
Seth, I want to get to the work that you both do. And I understand that your interest started because you were an insomniac yourself with a childhood bout with chickenpox. It burst your eardrums. Now, how does that affect your hearing?
Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on the day,
My hearing goes pretty much above the human norm, which makes it very irritating but convenient to work in a bat lab. I can hear when they're giving off the echolocation signals, which you normally need equipment for. Humans hear from about 20 hertz, 20 cycles per second, which is the lowest bass you can possibly imagine, up to about 20 kilohertz. And even though humans don't normally pay attention to sounds beyond that range, they can still be affected by them. And that's been the basis of a lot of our work, using not just sound, but how you change sound in ways that you don't pay attention to get specific effects.
Fast-forwarding the story, you guys knew each other, but then we understand, Lance, you were inspired by science fiction to ask Seth what?
Can we actually create sounds and music that will, you know, mess with people's brains? And Seth, of course, said, sure.
Why not mess with people's brains?
Well, first of all, sound is the fastest sensory system. Sound gets right to the brainstem, and the connections from your ears to your arousal centers, to sleep centers, to memory centers is much more direct than a lot of visual inputs.
Well, I just want to make sure I understand this. I mean, we all know sounds bother us. A fingernail on a blackboard bothers us. But you're talking about something getting into the brain like a probe would and doing something.
Yeah, you can actually get targeted responses if you understand very precise, mathematically rigorous processes.
Well, I'm going to take a listen to some sound, but Lance, you enter this whole process because while Seth is using sound to target parts of the brain that might have a certain reaction, you supply the music that carries some of the sound. Now, make the distinction, Lance, if you would, between your music and this sound that's been created that goes with it.
Basically, what will happen is, you know, Seth or someone or myself will say, okay, we want to achieve this particular emotional response or this particular physical response. And then Seth will say, well, this is the math you need to create that particular effect in the brain through the ears. So I'll sit down at the computer, write the code or design the sounds, and then I'll listen to it and say, okay, what context can I put this in that makes it musically viable?
Okay, well, let's listen just so we can get a sense of this. And again, we're not going to play too much. We don't want to be accused of having people fall asleep at the wheel or, you know, face down in their lunch. Just a few seconds of an adult sleep track without the effects. So, Lance, this is just your music synthesized?
Yeah.
Okay, now let's listen to a sleep track with the effects. Okay, that's enough.
Seriously.
It's been a long day.
The effects themselves, even though they're extremely powerful, you don't really notice them unless you're looking for them.
Well, Seth, is that the point, that sort of wah-wah there? You're kind of aware of it, but if you're too aware of it, then you'd be, I'd imagine you won't be sleeping. You'll be thinking, wow, what's that wah-wah?
The whole point of this is just the music is a carrier. If you listen too carefully to try to figure out what is that low-frequency rumble, you're paying attention, and paying attention increases your arousal and is bad for trying to fall asleep.
Okay, a couple questions. Why not just use white noise? You know, some people do that.
Mm-hmm. White noise can be very effective as a masker. And when you're in deep sleep, your brain is actually putting out bands of oscillating noise at specific rates. It's called the delta wave during certain stages of sleep. And what it's doing is basically dissociating the higher cortex, where you're thinking, you're dreaming, from the rest of your brain stem. But sound can make it right through. And so anyone who has what I have, which is I call alarm ears, any sound in the environment can wake you up. Mm-hmm. What we've done is we've taken three basic algorithms that affect different parts of the sleep cycle. The first one that we use is based on that low rumble that you might have heard in the effects track. It's really just a very, very low frequency sound. If you know anybody who, when they're a passenger, hopefully a passenger in a car, fall asleep, that's because of what's called Sopite syndrome.
Meaning what? What does that mean, Sopite syndrome?
Sopite syndrome is a form of motion sickness. It's the low constant frequency is telling my ears that I'm vibrating and it's activating the sleep centers. It's one of the reasons that you can rock a baby to sleep.
And that's why white noise masks sounds that might wake you, whereas the special effects that you work with will actually trigger something in the brain to help you to sleep.
Right. We also have two other algorithms, one of which is just what Lance calls the wobble.
Is this the soundtrack, which we're not going to play, which causes people to fall out of their chairs, as causes vertigo?
It's related to that. In this one, we're not trying to make them fall out of the chair, as funny as that was. This is sort of a deeper rocking of the baby to sleep.
We're not going to play that. Well, let's listen to some more of them, the ones that we can play without fear of, you know, harming anyone. In particular, one that makes you focus. Let's listen to that. Seth, I actually do feel like I'm focusing here. I felt some almost like a tingle. What's happening there?
What focus does is, Lance is using all musical elements. I gave him a series of algorithms which incorporated things like gamma band oscillation, which is something that you pick up on EEGs when the brain is very involved in processing specific tasks. And this was surprisingly successful for our first real run at it. I still listen to this while I have to sit there and read papers for a lab.
Well, there are skeptics of your work. University of Maryland electrical engineering professor Shihab Sharma says he doubts that specific sound frequencies can affect certain parts of the brain. But he said that it doesn't mean that what you think you are noticing isn't real. Do you ever, either of you, worry about, oh, mind control?
We've been accused of that since we started in 2000. It's not mind control any more than any good music is emotional manipulation. You go to a good movie, most of the emotional content is from the soundtrack.
Seth always says, sound is what you don't pay attention to.
But it drives your attention.
That's Seth Horowitz, assistant research professor of neuroscience at Brown University. Lance Massey, a composer and sound designer. In addition to that work, they're co-creators of Neuropop. Seth, Lance, thank you both.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And you're listening to a bit of their work, Eros. This is a track they say is designed to appeal to women, but not men. We'd love to hear what you think. Just go to hereandnow.org and leave a comment. But while there, you can also check out other samples of their work. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.